You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
We got a great podcast today. We have three guests. We have Dr. Sandy Jo MacArthur, who is a former assistant chief who served with the Los Angeles Police Department for 35 years. During her LAPD tenure, MacArthur oversaw implementation of the 2001 Department of Justice consent decree requirements, all interest level and in-service training, the 911 center, recruitment and hiring, internal behavioral science services, and the internal dispute resolutions program. Her expertise revolves around curriculum design, employee wellness, police tactics, and conflict management. Dr. Luann Pinnell is the Director of Instructional Design and Academic Innovation for the Policing Leadership Academy at the University of Chicago Crime Lab. Dr. Pinnell joined LAPD in 2000, where she supported officer and organizational wellness as a police psychologist at Behavioral Science Services until 2005. She was then promoted and served for 18 years in the role of Director, Police Training and Education. Tyler Dean Kempf is the creative director of Second City Works. He is an award-winning Second City-trained improviser, writer, director, and learning facilitator who has been teaching the tenets of improv to business leaders around the world for over a decade. This is a really interesting podcast. Enjoy it.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock.
Sandy Jo, Luann, Tyler, welcome to the pod.
Hello. Good morning.
Thanks for having us, Kelly.
All right. Sandy Jo, can you tell us a bit about the University of Chicago Crime Lab and the Policing Leadership Academy?
Sure. The University of Chicago Crime Lab, it's not your forensic crime lab like so many people often think, is actually a research organization. And it's an organization that likes to apply data-driven, evidence-based approaches to studying how you can reduce crime in cities and how you can reduce the violence associated with crime. It was founded in 2008. And what was really interesting about it is a collaboration with policymakers, city policymakers, as well as law enforcement agencies and then community organizations. So it sort of has all three rungs of the stool, you know, the important components. And they really wanted to bring it together with people who have expertise in those areas to see what they could find about strategies to reduce gun violence, how to reform the criminal justice system in a manner that's going to positively affect all of those three components. Really, a lot of their focus was on not just reforming the criminal justice and reducing violence, but looking at youth intervention programs and things like that. So throughout their tenure, and I've been involved with them for several years now, they've done a lot of really interesting research projects that a lot of universities just don't touch. And the Policing Leadership Academy is one of them. So it's really, the concept behind the Policing Leadership Academy is that if we train police leaders that are at the precinct divisional level, you know, that are responsible for a certain footprint within the larger agency's jurisdiction, that if we train them in data-driven practices, that they will actually be able to be more effective than they currently are at reducing crime and violence without totally destroying relationships in the community. So 3 years ago, well, actually 3.5 years ago, I was working on a few other projects with them, and they approached me and asked if I would be part of creating the Policing Leadership Academy, which was like so exciting. I was very excited about it. And of course, I pulled in my best friend, Luann, and said, hey, look at, listen to what we might have an opportunity to do. So it was really exciting because we both together, we have a lot of experience in law enforcement, but we also know tons of people, not just in law enforcement, but in the policy side of the shop, as well as community folks, where we've had our successes and we've had our failures. So we rolled our sleeves up and working with a variety of experts from all avenues, we were able to create a what is now a 5-week course for police leaders that are of the rank, depending on the agency, of captain, commander, in some cases, deputy chiefs. And we bring a group of 35 of them together, and we put them through a program that lasts 5 months, 1 week a month. Because part of the process that we've developed through this program is, one, we want to create a really robust network opportunity so that people across the country, across the globe, because we have some international guests as well, come together and we look at things like how do we use data-driven, evidence-based strategies to reduce crime and violence? How do we manage risk within the organization, both inside the organization, but also managing the risk outside the organization? And looking at how do you think strategically? We're good at thinking critically in moments of crisis, but strategic thinking is a different animal. So
interesting. Luann, what else is part of this? There's a capstone aspect of this program, right?
Absolutely. Yes. Well, when we were designing this course, we looked at everything across the country and everything that we'd experienced. And we just saw this incredible gap. But one of the things we want to do is leverage the time that they have together to go back and take things from the theoretical to the practical so that they're touching, they're wrestling with new ideas. And then they have a capstone that they do over the 5 months that actually puts into a working real world scenario that benefits them, their departments, their community, their officers. It's a really kind of different approach. It is part of the vehicle for them to learn all the things that we're teaching them. And it's been so really rewarding to see the kinds of successes they're having, even in that 5 months. One of the things that's different than many of our experiences going to school is that they're not doing this capstone for me or Sandy Joe or even for the university. It's really something that after the 5 months, they continue to work on. And many of them have taken their capstone that was in maybe one apartment complex, and now that they have a year behind them since they've graduated, they've extended it to other areas, and are having continued success. So it's really exciting to see them put it into practice.
Tyler, why would Second City be in this conversation?
Great question. When Sandy Joe and Luann asked us to come and present one of our Applied Improv workshops with this group, we wanted to focus on presentation skills, communication, storytelling, and that's our bread and butter, right? For over almost 40 years, we've been delivering that type of training to every level of employee from CEO down to intern at every industry around the world. And this was an opportunity for us to bring our teachings to a community that maybe we haven't worked with in the past, and we feel like we could really provide helpful insights and skill building that can improve not just their ability to communicate and storytell, but their relationships with their communities, and ultimately, provide opportunities for collaboration across differences. And so we were so grateful to be in that space, so grateful to work with all of those amazing participants and to see them, I would say, lean in more than they ever expected to within the first 30 minutes of our program.
Yeah. So Tyler and I were in the room with our colleague Tree Branch, and I was surprised at how quickly these folks responded to these improv exercises. They seemed to be putting two and two together even before we started doing the debriefs. Was that Sandy, Joe, and Luann? Was that your experience watching this?
Absolutely.
Yeah, 100%. And I just want to say something, Kelly, because Tyler, you triggered a thought. Luann and I are constantly looking at what could improve our learning in these classrooms. So prior to even, the stars all aligned with you all, prior yeah. to actually speaking with you, Kelly and Tyler, Luann and I are going, we need a block on how to tell your story. Hmm. Because Luann always says, you know, cops are like, dropped into a scene and they have to improv every single thing they do in the field. And I love that thought process. So we were literally trying to look at what could we do to make this happen for them in the classroom, because they themselves, the commanders who are in our class, they're uncomfortable sometimes just getting a microphone put in their face and asked a bunch of questions. So we're trying to figure out how to do this when the stars aligned and the crime lab introduced us to the two of you. So I will just say something was in the works far outside of our control. And it was perfect timing because so much is happening out there with our guys in the field every day, our men and women in the field every day, that what you are offering to us and what you taught us in that first class and what you saw where they leaned in immediately is because this is what they have to do every day. We just don't call it improv.
Yeah, that's right. And I should say we had a bit of a warm up because Tyler and I and Tree spent a week at Quantico at the FBI National Academy, and they roped us into leading a couple classes. And there as well, the response was terrific. And I guess we shouldn't be surprised after so many years, but you know, this is not an audience necessarily that we think is. I would assume a level of wariness with the improv guys when they walk in, and maybe that was there, but it was gone so quickly because, of course, then they're in playful practice with these embodied skills building around the things that are so essential. So, Tyler, what I thought was really interesting because we started with classic improv stuff, but then you ended up doing storytelling that you were drawing from classes you taught at Columbia College.
Absolutely. I think it's important for anybody, whether you're putting a presentation together and trying to get someone to hop on board with an idea that you have, or if you're speaking to press or you're speaking to somebody at a community meeting, it's important to understand the foundations of storytelling. We all have those skills in our bodies, right? We, as human beings, we are innate storytellers because it's been our form of communication since we were sitting around the fire and telling our tribes how we got dinner that night, right? Mm-hmm. And so it, just to take it down to the bare minimum and talking about before and after, beginning, middle, end, and really kind of giving them that foundation as to why we are going to explore these skills and the structure in which we want to try to stay within as we're communicating our story, while also making a connection. And a big part of that from our perspective at Second City Works is about meeting our audiences where they are, really truly understanding who we're speaking to, what their goals are, and then challenging ourselves to remove any information that might be irrelevant to them and focusing on the information that is truly relevant to them. And asking questions, bringing that curiosity to better understand your audience's goals, needs, expectations, so that you can adapt your story in the moment to meet the needs of who you're speaking to. That room did it wonderfully.
That is such a great point. One of the things that we see with our participants is just they have many audiences that they're speaking to, mm-hmm. and they're sometimes they focus so hard on being right and getting it right and perfect that they can sound robotic. And what concerns me is, you know, when you spend time with these individuals, you know what a big heart they have and how much care they have for the community and for their officers. But communication is everything. Mm-hmm. And so if that doesn't come across, sometimes you just have that one moment, that one either media or a community meeting, and you feel like if you blow it, you know, how do I recover from that? And so giving them the opportunity to be spontaneous, make mistakes, and kind of even laugh at themselves in their communications, getting to the place where their humanity can be expressed in it, because it's there. And it just breaks my heart when it's just behind a script. When you have that improv moment, they I think they want to engage it, but giving themselves permission to do it is another thing.
Well, and also because we're many selves. We're, you know, so, and that's not a thing that gets taught, but is true. You're going to behave in one way with one person, with your colleagues differently, when the door is closed differently. And when you do these exercises, you are allowing yourself to embody these different selves. And it's not really role playing. That's the other thing, which is, I think, what traditionally people would think. It is specific skills building, like an orchestra member would need to work on their scales, or a person in sports would, you know, work on their batting and then their fielding and all those things. And so I remember, Sandy Jo, I think you were even saying to me, like, because we did not pre-plan anything, right? We didn't. Right. We just had a conversation. You let us come in. And you're like, you guys were hitting our points.
Yeah, Kelly, to your point, Tyler just talked about curiosity. Luann and I drive curiosity, like, in everything we do in this course. We talk about it in terms of when you're interacting with people, but realistically, we really push it when we're talking about conflict. And so much of what police do is manage conflict. Sometimes they're the focus of the conflict. Sometimes they're jumped into the middle of the conflict. Sometimes they have no idea what the conflict is. And we have a tendency in law enforcement to say, always act like a cop, always be professional. And professional comes across as being hardened. Professionalism sometimes can come across as feeling it being like looking like you don't care, just the facts, ma'am, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what we use is the term curiosity to break that, right? You want to be professional, but curiosity, genuine curiosity, makes you want to really listen. And key to so much of what we do in policing is to listening, whether it's one-on-one with a victim, one-on-one with a suspect that we're trying to question, or we're at a big community meeting. If you're not truly actively listening, you're going to miss all kinds of really critically important pieces. So when you guys came in, I mean, Luann and I participated because we wanted to, and it was
so, and I was so grateful that you did.
It was awesome. But I also have to say, I kept wanting to find Luann and say, oh my gosh, this is it. This is what we talked about. And so afterwards in our debrief, why we were so excited about it and why I think that you saw so much right away from everybody leaning into it is because intuitively cops at every level know that we have to do a better job with communication. And that's what you were teaching. You were teaching ways in a fun, not so boring kind of way. You were teaching and reinforcing active listening skills, but you were also giving them skills in the improv, what we call the improv now, world of policing, where you never know what's coming at you. And if you aren't really leaning in and listening, your improv can fall flat and in many cases actually backfire on you. So the last piece I'll say on this one, Kelly, and I'll turn it back over to you. When we teach tactics, for example, in the field, we are telling them all the time, have your head on the swivel, keep your eyes out, because you might go in thinking, oh, this is a robbery in progress and it might actually be something else. And you can't make a mistake there because that can be deadly, right? And crucial. So this just brings that, in my opinion, sort of aligns the everyday communication in tough situations with what we teach tactically, but we just don't teach it in the way you guys teach it in most policing environments. So Luann and I are using the language now. It's, you know, you drop a cop into a call and it's improv from the start. Right. Yeah. So it's kind of a cool, you've shifted our language a bit on that. So I love it.
And I think, and I remember this from, we were observing classes at Quantico, and Tyler, I think you and I were in our friend Vince's class, which was this entire the class. It was a case study, and there was footage, and it was not pretty.
Yeah.
But the lesson at the end was like, and sometimes you do nothing, which was fascinating to me because it's like you're talking to a bunch of people whose instinct is to go through a wall, and that ability to pivot. Is hard, and it requires a level of practice, because you can get the knowledge, but you know, unless you have like know what it feels like to stop where you're going, I don't know that you can. I mean, Tyler, is that your experience?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that I love so much about the work that we get to do and the opportunities we get to provide our participants is, even though each individual exercise is chosen for a specific skill that we want to unpack during the debrief of the exercise, there are lessons that are taught just by participating in all of them. And one of them is just that ability to be agile, right? To just pivot in the moment, even if we're not focused on agility in that particular exercise, it's challenging them to be open to opportunities and making new choices. And the other thing that I want to go back to something that Sandy Jo said earlier is the other skill that I think is incredibly important, especially for these participants, that they get to practice through the entire time of our workshop, is the skill of being vulnerable. That is when we can really let our humanity through to connect with another human being through listening, through asking questions, and through sharing of our own experiences. Because if we're in that moment truly being present for that other person, that other person is going to naturally mirror our own behaviors, and we'll be vulnerable together and connect on a more deeper human level to move forward together.
So one of our key areas of learning has to do with emotional intelligence. We cover that in the first week and we dive into it. But, you know, you can see people kind of wrestling with it. And what I love about your program is it takes that and puts it into an application, right? So yeah. I can understand. One of the things we have them do is they take an emotional intelligence test, and they actually have a virtual consultation with one of our psychologists who helps them work through. But now by the time they get to you, they've been wrestling with some of these things and going, okay, maybe how do I express empathy? How do I express different kinds of emotions? You know, appropriately so at the right time, but for the purpose of those connections. And so it just wove beautifully with our content of the course and pushing it into an application focus. And once you've practiced it a little, something ignites, like you get curious again, and you think about how you can apply this in the workplace and in different places.
Before we came in and worked with your class, the night before the entire group, or most of the group, came to the Second City and saw a show. And there was one participant who was very vocal during the opening of our class that he had walked out of our show. The class was giving him a hard time for it. But I was grateful that he was very open and honest about it. And at the end of the class, he came up to me and he said, "I have never regretted walking out of something before. And I absolutely wish that I could go back and stay in that theater to continue to watch those performers do what we just did." To see that transformation in him, in the 3 hours that we had, was awesome, and showed that when you lean into it and you engage with it in this low stakes environment, as you said, Kelly, practice and play, you get the opportunity to try skills on that you may not get in other experiences.
I'm sorry, Kelly, go ahead.
No, I was just I just need to say this. As we sit here in the year of our Lord, February 21st, 2025, to be able to reflect on that moment, which was so beautiful, and we're living at a time where it feels like everyone's doing the opposite. And it's like, you know what? We don't all have to believe the same thing. We don't have to all have the exact same values or believe it, but we can connect as human beings to make situations better. And we do it every day. That is the majority of the time. We just have media and politics and other things being fed into our brains that's painting such a bad story. Sorry, that's what I want to add.
No, 100%. And I was kind of going down that same path, because the same individual came to us, and Luann and I, and said the same thing. And what I think is very interesting with people in our line of work in the law enforcement world, we have a tendency to think of vulnerability as going to make it so that we could lose our lives, right?
Yeah.
And because we always talk about, don't put yourself in a vulnerable position that somebody could attack you, blah, blah, blah. And that is very, very important. But we hammer that into them, because that's what does save lives, both officers and the community lives, right? However, they then take that concept and they then remove vulnerability from every other aspect of their life. And to your point, Kelly, that's what's happening out there today.
Yeah.
So what you did in that 3 hours is you drove home how you can still be very safe in whatever you're doing and still be vulnerable in terms of connecting with people, because that's really that is key to finding out what the real issues are in so many cases. And we have done a poor job historically when we're dealing with our victims of crimes. And I think these are the kinds of skills that are really, really important for folks to see, is how it can really actually improve your ability to stay safe in situations, because you get more information and you also build trust. And sometimes those things don't go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. You know, if I can just add something about our class, with our class so far, we have over 70 jurisdictions in 34 states who've come to our class. They cover areas that account for over 33% of the homicides in the U.S. And so part of their capstones, while they're working at reducing violence, it's a constant theme in our course that you can reduce violence while increasing community trust. You just have to be very intentional about it. So the piece of their capstones, they are required to have stakeholders and to build bridges and to kind of bring other people into the public safety conversation. It wasn't ever meant to be. It can't survive this way to only be a policing solution. Public safety is everybody's concern. And so when you bring in more community members about it onto their capstones, it's just more sustainable and you have success over time instead of just sporadic successful, you know, operations. But the connection with being able to think about how to really engage community members, and Kelly, you and I were talking a little bit earlier, we've been so optimistic at times, you know, since 2020, it's been really hard building some of those bridges, but we are getting such great stories back from our participants about how community members are leaning in also and engaging, but it's that matched vulnerability. It's that piece of, I'm going to ask them to be on this stakeholder meeting and to try to offer their ideas. And then I really need to listen and be curious and also be somewhat vulnerable to engage this and come up with different solutions. So I think that's where we get a lot of great creativity, you know, in those solutions.
So I don't know if I told this to you two. So 10 years ago, found myself at the University of Chicago in a meeting with Heather Caruso, who ran the Center for Decision Research then. Richard Thaler was her boss. And we were cooking up. She and I got very excited about how you blend behavioral science and improvisation. And our first thought, we were like, we got to do a program together. And the first thing we thought was, we could use this, these skills, if we could just get everyone to take a beat. That's what we wanted to teach. We're like, you know, this is, and we were thinking in terms of the work you do, and it's about self-regulation and that idea of like, don't reach for a gun, you know, take a beat, everyone. And we ended up having to pivot because the money came from, you know, executive education in the business school. So this thing that we did, the Second Science Project for about 4 years, ended up being still about creating bespoke exercises that took the evidence from behavioral science and brought improv in to teach people. And Tyler works with this stuff, you know, now with a variety of different clients. But so interesting that 10 years later, we find ourselves being able to be back doing the thing we kind of wanted to do at the beginning. And I don't know, it just feels like a gift to me.
Well, it's a gift to us, too.
Yeah. All right, Luann, I want to read. So I went to the website for the Crime Lab, and I pulled this from there. It says, the challenge. Americans are deeply worried about American cities. A 2022 Gallup poll showed that 80% worry a great deal, fair amount, about crime and violence. That is understandable. The murder rate in the United States today is about the same as it was in 1900. Well, okay, wow. But as we were talking before, you know, that was 3 years ago. You kind of feel like things might be better.
Well, we're hearing that back from both officers and community members. And we're very intentional about also bringing community members into the academy and into the experience. And like I said, making it a part of the capstone. Sandy Jo, you're involved in a lot of things across the country. Do you want to comment on that?
Sure. I'll jump in. So we had a really big low after COVID and everything that was going on. I think the world as a whole had a low in terms of trusting anything to do with governments and everything. And we were seeing the backlash of that because of all the demonstrations that were going on with Black Lives Matter and things like that. But what I think people don't always understand is law enforcement actually pivots pretty quickly, when at least in this century. And when we saw what was happening and the distrust that was going out there, a lot of really good policing leaders started to jump together and say, okay, we've got to do something to start to build trust. And so in a very short period of time, we've seen a lot of improvements in terms of relationships. Are we where we want to be? Absolutely not. Do we need to continue to move forward? Yes. But because, and again, Luann, I think you already addressed the crime rate. We're starting to see crime rates drop, which is good. And sometimes people will tout, oh, our crime is as good as it was, you know, in 2017. And then I say, yeah, but is it as good as it was, you know, in 2014 or whatever, right?
Yeah.
If you look at it just in clumps of 5 years, you're not really seeing the big picture because crime ebbs and flows. So what we're starting to see is a lot more transparency in the world of what crime rates really mean. And I think a lot more empathy from police who are stopped saying, oh, look at how much we've dropped crime in the last 5 years. Because if you're a victim of a crime, I don't care what the crime rate is.
No.
And so I think what we're seeing across the country is crime rates are starting to come down, but policing agencies are not satisfied with that because they're still dealing with the aftermath of violence. And in some pockets of our agencies across the country, crime doesn't feel like it's down at all. And in some cases, it's not. So what we're starting to see is that what's really important is trust, building trust. Because when you build trust, crime rates sometimes go up, especially when you're talking about certain pockets that have been at war, if you will, with policing. So when you start to build trust, then they're more comfortable coming forward and saying, hey, I've been a victim of a crime, or hey, this police officer got heavy handed with me. So a lot of times as trust builds, crime rates and complaints start to go up, and then they start to go down. Because now we're starting to find the real problems, and now we can work on them collaboratively with our community partners. So it's it's a complex dynamic.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And Tyler and I were in a meeting before this, because we are building a class with our friend Mark to pitch to Kellogg. It's for the business school, and that class is about trust and relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So Tyler, let's just riff a little bit, because you and I've been talking about this very idea, like they don't teach trust in business school. I don't know where they teach, you know, ethics program, like, you know, CCD, I don't know, but it's crucial for everything.
Absolutely. And the basic skills that we teach in our workshops are the foundations for how to build trust, right?
Yeah.
How to earn that psychological safety from someone else or from a room. And how much that can positively impact you together, and also you as an individual. And so, being a thoughtful listener, really engaging all the way through when someone is speaking to you, and not getting lost in your own thoughts in the moment, asking questions with authentic curiosity, and providing structure to have conversations when there are disagreements that allows for a moment of gratitude before sharing your own perspective. Those are the small things that we can do that are the bricks that you can build to get to that moment of trust. And that trust, like you said, Kelly, can be, we've spoken about this. There's trust that can be just in that moment, and there's relationships that are just for a short amount of time. But then there's also relationships and trust that can be long lasting, even if you don't speak to each other for 5 years at a time.
So here's an example too. I just want a quick example and then you riff on that. Okay. But one thing that we do before we go out on stage at Second City or before a workshop is we pat each other on the back and say, got your back. Yeah. That is a trust ritual. And I can tell you, it makes me feel more energized going into the room. It makes me feel like, cause I know it's true. And I know that like, if I flounder at a moment, Tyler's going to pop in and vice versa. And this idea of like two improvisers on stage, what they know is that the other person's job is to save them. And,
absolutely.
And that is a fantastic mindset to walk through the world with.
I would build on that and say it's not just that they're going to save me. It's that my job is to make my scene partner look like a rock star.
Yeah.
And I know my scene partner is going to do the same thing for me. And there's that trust there. So when improvisers who are well-trained improvise together for the first time, it's as if they've been improvising together forever, because we just agree that that is how we work together in this space to develop a scene out of nothing.
I just was going to say that whole framework really resonates with law enforcement, that I'm going to look out for you and I trust that you're going to look out for me. You're not going to let me be my worst enemy and fail. You're going to jump in and support me. And so when you started with some of that, you know, we continued that conversation and said, what if we build, you know, cultures within our departments, within our communities, where we feel that kind of trust. But to your point, we talk about it sometimes, but putting it into an application, and your debriefs are really good for getting to the heart at what did we just do there? It seemed like a silly exercise, or it seemed like something, but what did we just do? And then peeling back the layers, like, we're building trust. It took trust for you to share that, you know, and for some of our folks, they've expressed in our class and in your class, I wouldn't have shared this normally. I wouldn't have done that. And so then when we start peeling back the layers and go, well, what were the dynamics that allowed you to do that? You know, why here? Why now? And how can then you create that in the spaces that you work?
A big part of that for us is also to remove judgment of both of ourselves and of others. Yeah. And, you know, removing judgment of ourselves is the more difficult of the two. Yes. Right. We're constantly concerned about what we look like or what we sound like or what anybody may think about us at any given moment. And that can prevent us from being bold, making choices and being making brave choices. So when one participant in a room starts to share something that clearly is because of the energy in that space, it's a domino effect.
Yeah.
And it's so amazing to experience that. And again, we experience that with every group, no matter the industry, no matter their role. But in that room in particular, and at Quantico as well, where we're working with folks who, you know, have a tough exterior for a variety of reasons, it's beautiful. I'm so grateful to be in those spaces.
So there's two points that you guys have, like, just these discussions could go on forever, and I just love them. So one of the things regarding trust that I think is really important, and Luann and I have really tried to drive this home, and you guys are bringing it to the surface. There is what I call the physical trust and the psychological trust. I physically trust you, Tyler, that we go out there, you can do what's necessary to get the job done. But do I trust you're going to do it and do it in the right manner? That's going to be good for all. So it's really, there's those two aspects of trust that end up being really important. And then the other piece that I think is so important is the issue of judgment. When we're dealing with conflict, we always talk about there's multiple perspectives in conflict. So stop judging, you know, from your perspective only, and start listening so you can better understand. You may never agree with some of the other perspectives, but you can understand where they're coming from. You cannot understand it if you're judging them. And that's counterintuitive to what we do to stay alive every single day, to drive safely, to pick up our kids from school or whatever. We judge. Humans judge. So now I'm asking you to really step into this very odd place and say, in this moment, don't judge. Listen. And it that takes psychological trust to do that as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah,
we talk about replacing blame with curiosity, right?
So that's
an adage. That is a, you know, and I don't know. I think I credit it to age mostly, that I'm in a place now where I'm able to see people as many things, and in a moment when there is a conflict, you know, reach for, how can we make this better? You know, what can we do to solve what's going on? Because, you know, the yelling just is more yelling. You know, I've had enough of yelling. All right. We always end the podcast with a yes and story. And Tyler, I'm actually going to go with you first.
Oh, okay. Great. I'm going to go back to March of 2020. I was living in Los Angeles with my husband. He worked at a movie theater and I was traveling the world delivering, you know, applied improv workshops to a variety of audiences all over the place. And my work started to disappear off my calendar. His theater closed, and we needed to make a choice because we could tell that this was not going to be a short-term thing. Even though our landlord, when I called him to tell him I couldn't pay rent next month, he's like, this will be over in a few weeks. I was like, I don't think so. My parents had moved to Las Vegas about a year and a half prior. And so we made the choice to say, maybe we go to Vegas. We drove up there, looked at houses to rent, rented a house and moved all within a week. And we didn't do any planning up to that point. We just did it. And I'm so grateful that we did because we were able to beat that exodus out of Los Angeles into Las Vegas, be with our family during that time and build relationships with family that we hadn't lived near in almost 20 years.
Oh, great. Sandy Jo.
Okay. There's so many cool ones because I've been trying to think of this since you said you were going to ask it, but I'm going to bring it back to what we were talking about today. So I've been working on some smaller projects with the Crime Lab for several years after I retired in 2015. And the then director, executive director, Rosanna, came to me and said, "Hey, SJ," and she poses this gigantic project for the Policing Leadership Academy and tells me it's going to be a randomized control trial. And, you know, instinctively, you're like, no way, this is too huge. And I said, yes. And I'm going to bring in several people that are going to help me create this curriculum, that this curriculum is going to be the best thing since sliced bread, literally, for law enforcement. And yeah, there is a little bit of me, kind of like you, Tyler, like, what the heck did I just say yes to? I haven't talked to all my buddies in law enforcement. Will they jump in on this? And it was everything I could have hoped for and more. From my second call, I think, was to Luann after I told my husband, I might be doing a lot of work in Chicago. And then, you know, I call Luann. She's still working at LAPD. And I know that there was a lot of issues, but I call Bill Bratton, I call Charlie Beck, I call Larry Snelling, I call Luann Pinnell, I call General Stan McChrystal, right? I call people from all over the country, all walks of life, and the first thing they say is, I'm in. And I never, ever expected us to be here talking to Second City about how you can come in and teach a class in a policing leadership academy. So again, you guys were another one, you know, yes, and bring them in, let them teach it. I don't want to make this class up. They got the experience. So there's a lot of yes ands that I think are really cool and valuable. So I loved that exercise. Luann, I'll throw it to you.
Okay. Well, kind of to Sandy Jo's, that's just a great example, even saying yes to this project. But just to give a different perspective, back at LAPD, I was asked to rewrite some curriculum that was done for our officers regarding working with gang interventionists. And when this first came about, it was kind of a real stretch for people to get their arms around how are we working with former gang members to reduce crime and violence in the neighborhoods that we're working. And so I brought together a group of seasoned gang detectives and also these gang violence interrupters. And you're kind of like, how's this going to go? So the yes was, of course, I had to do it. It was my job. But also, how much do I dive into this? You know, because I could just give them an outline and say, hey, please give me your feedback. But I really wanted to get them working together. And I actually took the music from a LA Kings hockey game and brought that in there and got him. Because the theme of it is We Are Los Angeles. And I got them all pumped up and to go, no, we are Los Angeles. Like, hockey shouldn't even exist in Los Angeles. But we are Los Angeles. How do we take that back and own our our streets and our cities and also save lives. Like, what a big mission that is. And in many ways, I see the work in the PLA as just a continuation of that, of all the work that we've done, of all these different connections that Sandy Jo mentioned. There's so much support about how can we do this? How can we change the narrative that's happening out there, not just, you know, with the crime statistics, but also in how we communicate it back to our communities. So that's probably my yes and.
I love that both of the stories are about collaboration and yes anding together with others.
Yeah. That's right. Great stories. Sandy Jo, Tyler, Luann, thanks for coming on the pod.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much, Kelly.
Thank you. See you soon.
Be safe.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.